Fred, I guess, was somebody, you know, I'd see on the campus, we wave at each other, and he was very popular because of not only the playmakers in general, but he had that wonderful Christmas reading of the Dickens Christmas Carol.
Uh-huh.
All 4 Decembers that I was at Chapel Hill as a student, I went to hear him read the Christmas Carol in Memorial Hall. So we were conscious of him. People like Odom, again, because of the political union, I knew, and of course I knew him when I went back on the faculty, but I was, the faculty member I became closest to of all was Francis Bradshaw, who was the Dean of Students and a professor of philosophy, and he taught what became, in a parochial sense, a famous seminar for seniors, which met in his office at night, and he was a very influential person in my scheme of things. And when I wanted advice of some kind, I might throw sentiments against him and see what he thought.
You haven't mentioned anyone in political science or history.
Oh, well.
I mean, this is where you spent most of your academic time.
Well, I decided on political science. And the department was small then. It had, as I recall, 7 faculty members. Watley Pearson, who was dean of the graduate school, and in fact whom I succeeded as dean of the graduate school in 1958, was on the faculty, taught political theory. Bill Jenkins taught constitutional law. Keena Frazier taught international law and international relations. Jim Fetzel taught public administration. Pat Robson taught comparative government, German government. That doesn't add up, quite 7, I think, but they were a stable group, and they were very important to my academic experience. Or Woodhouse, E.J. Woodhouse, never had a course with Woodhouse, but Woodhouse was famous for giving all A's and B's, and very interesting. He wasn't any good for the very poor students, and he wasn't any good for the very good students, but in that mass in the middle, maybe 2/3 or 1/3, he was just enormously effective because he emphasized current events, and he talked politics, and talked contemporary issues, and talked contemporary personalities. He'd been mayor of Northampton, Massachusetts once when he'd been at Smith. And Woodhouse was the faculty advisor to the Carolina Faculty. And so he was very important to me, though I never had a course with him. Very interesting. So I knew all these faculty members and had courses with just about all of them, I guess.
And then in history, I believe Fletcher Green was the elder statesman there, wasn't he?
Well, he wasn't so elder then.
He wasn't?
When I went on the faculty in 1950, Fletcher was, maybe he was an elder statesman then, but he was coming into it. He was an excellent person. Interesting, when Gene and I went there, hot as Hades in the summer of 1950, lived out in the Glen Lennox, which was just building then. And one Sunday afternoon, a knock came on the door to hear that Fletcher Green's were coming to call. Now, you see, in the 30s, that would have been routine, mandatory, and expected.
Yeah.
But then they were still doing it.
They were still following those traditions.
And which was very nice.
Yeah.
We liked them both very much. They were very hospitable. I don't think Fletcher, I think he probably looked on me as a little bit too far left.
He was not himself very much of a...
No.
Of a progressive.
He looked on me as probably too far, but he was a gentleman, you see, and he always treated our people in a gentle way.
Yeah.
He was, I thought, a very constructive member of the department, though in political things he probably didn't agree very much.
What about your student contemporaries? Who are some of the ones who stand out in your memory?
My closest friend there, as a student and also later until he died, was Fred Weaver, Fred Weaver was the class of 1937, and I guess became the permanent president of the class of 37. And he worked in Francis Bradshaw's office as some kind of student assistant, I think, in his senior year, and then he went in as a full-time person. He eventually, before it was all over, became dean of students at Chapel Hill, and then went into the office of the Consolidated University of North Carolina. And then about 1967 or so, he was asked by the Ford Foundation to go to India. And the Ford Foundation had a very large program in India. And Fred went there with his wife and four children. And when Gene and I went, I became a trustee of the foundation, and we went to India in 1970, and we saw the Weavers. Then Fred, they visited us after that, but in, I think it was January 9th, I think 1972, that he was playing tennis and had a heart attack on the tennis court in India. He was my closest friend, both most compatible, I think, intellectually in matters of taste and so forth, and socially, I guess, we saw more of each other than others. Max Smith was in my class. We were very close friends, partly because, well, we were close friends because he was editor of the student newspaper, and and I was an important news source, or at least the things that the Carolina Political Union did were important. And he was a Deke, lived right next door to SAE House, where I stayed, and we were very good friends as undergraduates, and then we went to Columbia together the next year. He did the law school and I for the graduate school. So we had that year in Columbia. We lived not far from each other on the Columbia campus, and so we became good friends.
This was right out of, right after graduation,
yeah,
you went?
In the fall of 38. Okay. He and I both went to New York, out of the, to the Department of Public Law and Government at Columbia, and he did the law school at Columbia. And I lived in John Jay Hall, he lived in Fernal Hall, it wasn't very far apart. So we saw each other then. So but we were very close friends on the campus. A man named George Steele from Rockingham, North Carolina, who died about 1952, very early, who was in law school, I guess, when I was an undergraduate. We were very good friends. And he was interested in Carolina Political Union and great friend. He was one of those who would go over to the Grahams on Sunday night. Bob McGill, who was president of the student body, who's now dead, and after graduation went as the director of the Graham Memorial for a couple of years, I guess. And I were very good friends. A man named Randy Berg from Randall C. Berg from Jacksonville, Florida. He's a fraternity brother, and we had a lot in common. We had lived next to each other in Steele Hall our freshman year. That's how I got to know him, especially. So there were a lot of.
What about Phil Hammer?
Oh, and Phil, class of 36. We were and still are very cordial friends, very good friends. I saw a lot of him over the year. Well, a lot. He went to Harvard on a three-year thing, 1 year which he spent back in Washington working for Senator somebody, La Follette maybe, and that was my year as chairman of the political union, so he was, I'd see when I went to Washington recruiting mm-hmm. these people. And we had a lot in common, very good rapport, and I like Jane Ross's wife, too, very much. And when the Hammers would come back to Chapel Hill. When we were living there, we often saw them. And so he was, even though he was two classes ahead, Joe Barnett was another person who had, Joe, I guess, was in Phil's class, 36. He came from California. And he later recruited me to go into the Southwest Field Training Program in Albuquerque after I had been out of Chapel Hill 1 year in June of 39. Barnett had been working up there a couple of years. Well, people like Sam Hobbs from Alabama. Sam Hobbs, his father was a member of Congress from Alabama, and he had been active in the Carolina Political Union. We were in the same class, 38. And there were various fraternity brothers.
Some others I'm not sure were contemporaries of yours, but I wonder if they were. Vermont Royster?
No.
He did...
As Van Hecke, who was the dean of the law school, when I was dean of the graduate school, and therefore taking part in commencement, and Van, as we called him, whom I was very fond of, he was dean of the law school when I was an undergraduate, so I think still dean when I... And he was still dean when I came back on the faculty years later. Deans went on forever. But I'll never forget. I think it was my first commencement. And they gave the honorary degrees, and Van Hecke read the citation for Vermont, Connecticut, Royster. And he had occasion to pronounce it about three times during the whole. Vermont, Connecticut, Royster. But I did not know Royster.
Yeah. Walker Percy?
Oh, I knew Walker well. See, we were fraternity brothers.
Yeah.
He was a year ahead of me.
He was 1 year ahead of you?
Yeah. I thought of Walker the other day. We were in Sewanee. And the last time I ever saw Walker was in 1947 at Sewanee. I went by to see him there. I was going from Nashville to someplace up back, when I was doing this interviewing for Southern Politics book for Keene. And he had gone to P&S, Physicians and Surgeons in New York, the medical school, in the year I was in New York. I'd gone and we'd seen each other then. But we corresponded a bit over the years, and he came to the Vanderbilt campus two or three times while I was in office, but I was never in town for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would write him the letter and say, I'm sorry, and he'd write back and say thank you. That kind of thing. Walker was a... And, of course, I was a very good friend, and still am, of Leroy, Walker's brother. Leroy and I were in the same class, and also fraternity brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And a very interesting family.
Yeah.
And they had had some connections with Augusta, Georgia. Their mother was a Finnesy or something of that sort. And as you know, the parents died in Korea. They were reared by their uncle. So Roy, you asked me who were good friends. Roy Percy and I were very good friends. Tony Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
Walker was a very sensitive person.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then he got the damn tuberculosis.
Right.
I guess right when he finished medical school, approximately.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe he was interning for that. And very sensitive. He had literary interests. What I would be now called literary interest. I don't know if I'm there. When he was an undergraduate, I recall, he wasn't one of these hail fellow well met people. He was introspective, not necessarily introvert. And of course, he turned out to have considerable insight and talent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I found a couple of quotes of yours that. Should have written down where these came from. One of these, I'm sure, was in your introduction to Wilma Dykeman and Jim Stokely's book on Will Alexander. The other was in a piece that someone wrote about you. The first says, in the 30s, we had more of an attitude of service to the South as the South than was true later, I think. And then the second one was, my sense of regional obligation was strengthened by Frank Graham. I came out of college with an interest in working for the Southern region.
That's right.
Talk about that notion that's implicit in both of those.
Yeah. Well, it's been very important in my life because I made some decisions which grew out of that kind of sentiment and conviction. In the 30s, the appropriation of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and maybe of all higher educational institutions in the state, not sure, probably so, or maybe the whole state budget, in any event, a reduction of 15%. And Dr. Frank had this fierce problem of how to cope with that. and how to hold the faculty in the face of this reduction. Now, of course, there were parlous times elsewhere also in the country, but still the South was functioning at a lower economic level than other sections of the country, than all of the sections of the country, I believe, at that time. And he had to appeal to faculty members on grounds other than monetary grounds, to stay at Chapel Hill, I guess in some cases to come to Chapel Hill. I remember once in a convocation in Memorial Hall, I think it was there, he said that faculty members who, as a group, could have earned $100,000 more per year by going elsewhere, had seen the light of dedication and whatnot in the state of Chapel Hill. Now, that could have been 50 faculty members who forewent $2,000 apiece, which would have been an enormous thing in those days.
Yeah.
So Frank made there was a great consciousness of region. It's something that we don't have any awareness of now. Great consciousness of region. I wrote somewhere once that we who graduated from college about 38, 9, 40, were the last of the post-Civil War generation, which is right. The Civil War was a very strong, important presence in my rearing. You know, when I went to my grandmother's house in Augusta, and memories and relics and reminders of the Civil War were everywhere, and most of all in the minds of those ancient people whom I knew and liked very much, my Aunt Lily and my cousin Annie and my Aunt Katie and my grandmother, who was a girl of 15 or 16 when the war began and so on. And the sense, the regional awareness, self-consciousness, was very strong. Now, Mr. Graham saw the University of North Carolina as a vehicle for the state of North Carolina, and by inference the whole South, lifting itself by its own bootstraps. And of course the great vehicle for that was education, something which Haycock had seen at the turn of the 17th century, and others all in between. And a sense of mission about the region really found its way into my awareness and that of others. And you know, people talked about staying home instead of going off to New York. Of course, the great thing was, as we know, when I came to Vanderbilt, three of the largest banks in New York were headed by Vanderbilt alumni, or had just been, who were graduates of this institution, and who were all Southerners, men of, you know, obviously great ability to become the head of the Morgan Guaranty Trust Company, as Henry Alexander did, unless you're an enormously able person. And so there was this migration from all over the South, not just Tennessee. It was certainly too true in Georgia and from Savannah. I mean, a lot of the Avis people left. Well, they went to the land of opportunity. Where you go?
Everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere. And so Dr. Graham was, he preached a little bit the message of stay home, young man, as a notion of service to the area and to the region. Now, where were we in this? What else?
Well, still in all, I would be inclined to think that his objective, his purpose in trying to instill that sense of mission in his charges, was not quite the same as that of your elders in Savannah or mine in Kentucky, that you hark back to the Civil War and what it stood for, it was really a message of stay and help change.
Oh, no, no, that was it. Oh, no, it wasn't let's preserve the old South or anything of that kind. Oh, no, it was we've got this great set of challenges.
And yet he appropriated that sense of pride and duty and whatnot came out of that same...
Oh, he was a master at that, yes. But it was always forward-looking. It was progressive. And, you know, he, as you know, because you studied his record, I mean, he was gotten all kinds of fusses. The textile workers, there was a big textile strike, you know, in Charlotte or someplace. And
Greensboro,
and he, forgotten what he did, he stood up for them in some way, and he suffered. See, all those, you talk about his popularity, he had a lot of enemies. A lot of enemies around the state. And people who disagreed with him, and some enemies in Chapel Hill and in the student body. I mean, after all, the sons of these people,
sure,
big mill owners came to Chapel Hill School. So, but the concept of service to the South as a region was a very tangible thing, and one that had great influence on me, and I think had influence on others as well. It never occurred to me that I would work and live anywhere except in the South. And that fact accounted in significantly for my desire to go out while still young and see something of the rest of the country. And that's why one of the big appeals of my going to the Southwest, which I did, was that. And going into the Foreign Service, which I did, to see some other part of the world, but always with the notion that I would attribute considerably to Chapel Hill of coming back to the region and trying to do what little bit one could do in the in the region.
Before we leave the UNC in the 30s, one other thing I wanted to ask you about was the YMCA at Chapel Hill.
Very important organization. Harry Coma, graduate of Vanderbilt class of 1912, was the YMCA secretary when I was there.
Did you go over to Blue Ridge in the summers during
no.
that time?
No.
Were you acquainted with Will Weatherford, WD?
Yes. Of course, you know, he got his degrees at Vanderbilt.
Got his degrees here.
And I became acquainted with him, and he had started the YMCA college on there. Which was pulled down. I became very conscious when I came to Vanderbilt. Of course, I had read everything I could on the history of the institution and all that sort of thing, and tried to learn who its eminent sons and daughters were, but not. Weatherford, of course, stood out, because he'd gotten his I call a PhD in 1903, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And he had had this very important career, headed the institution, his son subsequently.
Berea.
Yeah, Berea. And anyway, so he may have written me, you know, when the new boy coming in and something, but I remember once his 90th birthday, I called him up on his 90th birthday to congratulate him on behalf of the university, wish him well on behalf of the university. But I didn't know him at the time. I didn't get to know him until later.
But the Y was an important institution on most college campuses.
It was very important. Of course, as we mentioned earlier, Frank Graham had been the Y secretary way back. Harry Coma and Jane Coma, both of whom I got to know well as a student, but then later on, Jean and I came to know Jane especially. In fact, Jane came when I was installed here in 1963, take the oath and so on. Jane came the whole way from Texas, I guess it was. I think it was Texas.
Yeah.
She may have still been living in Virginia then, I'm not sure. But anyway, she came, so we were very good friends then. The Y was a very important organization in the 30s. I don't know what it is now at Chapel Hill.
Yes.
But it was very important because it was a sort of one of its functions. It was kind of a place where students, so-called leaders, could go, and it was a kind of pool around which they congregated.
Mm-hmm.
And Coma was very good in relating to these students. And then they had functions. They used to, we had meetings and discussion groups. Mm-hmm. There was a discussion group of some kind that I was a part of.
Right.
Met periodically.
Right.
There were other things of that sort.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you graduated in 38, Phi Beta Kappa.
Yeah.
And went straight to Columbia that fall.
That's right.
Pick the story up there and carry it along a little way.
I will. That summer, I worked for the Works Progress Administration in Atlanta in something called the Historical Records Survey. The summer of my junior year, as I said, I'd gone to summer school for one semester, but the summer of my sophomore year, I worked for the National Park Service. And the summer of my freshman year, I was in the CCCs down on Coxville Island, Fort Pulaski, down in Elton, Savannah. All right. I went to Columbia somebody might say this is an inefficient way to lead your life, but I had applied to four places, Harvard, Yale, Chicago, and Columbia, and Columbia had come through with financially most attractive. And I saw New York, being in New York is an asset in itself. And I went there saying I did not plan to complete a master's degree. Well, they don't know what the hell he was doing there. That everything had pointed, and all the faculty advice I'd gotten, that Alec, you ought to go on to graduate school. But remember, this is the time of the New Deal, and this is the time that perceived effective governmental and social action to improve the lot of humankind. And so I wasn't about to sign up, either commit myself internally to graduate work or to sign up for a whole year, but I saw the opportunity to go to graduate school to learn some more about our nation and our government and our policies and our problems, and to be in New York City, which was an education industry.
Sure.
And so I did, and it was a very successful year. I did all the courses and whatnot and did not write what was called a master's essay then. And I applied for an appointment in the National Institute of Public Affairs. National Institute of Public Affairs was then in about its third year, an organization in Washington funded maybe altogether by the Rockefeller Foundation, which selected people, men and women around the country, come to Washington and be placed in internships in government agencies. And the come-on was that they would be very favorable placements in the office of the secretary of this or the assistant attorney general or something. And they chose, again, they had no stipend. And there was an educational program that went along with it. You could take courses at American University, and there was a monthly, weekly, Monday night seminar and so forth. A man named Fred Davenport, who had been a member of Congress from New York, was the president of it, and there were two other fellows. A man named Henry Reining was really the number two man. It was very competitive, and they chose very carefully. And the people in that program they were, as you know, students are the greatest educators of other students, and it was a very good program, and I applied for that. Davenport had an interview meeting in New York and was accepted. Then after all that was sort of set, and I went by Chapel Hill to be sure the place was still there, after I wasn't sure it would be after my year at Columbia. And I remember in the SAE House a telegram arrived from this man, Joe Barnett, I mentioned, who was offering me an internship again. The position was called Field Aide in the Southwest Field Training Program in Albuquerque, which was also sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation and had a connection to the NIP, National Public Affairs in Washington. But the Department of the Interior was the sponsor of this. And that was the chance to go to New Mexico to work in the Indian Service And to test the hypothesis that you could train better and develop administrative talent faster by taking people carefully selected of promise and putting them in positions of considerable authority rather than making climb the ladder. That was the hypothesis being tested now. And so the NIPA gave me leave to do that, and with the provision, I mean, with the understanding that I'd come back for a while during the winter, which I did. Went back at the end of November and stayed until the end of March, and worked in the Department of the Interior on a study of Puerto Rico. So I went out to Albuquerque, and magnificent experience. Again, rather carefully chosen people, very able people, quite a diverse group, more diverse, I guess, than the NIPA people in Washington. And I wound up there as the administrative officer for the health division of the United Pueblos Agency. At five hospitals, one way up in Taos, one way out to the west of Zuni, one in Santa Fe, and a TB San, and a hospital in the Albuquerque. Eight public health deal areas. And that's pretty good administrative experience, and I fitted it. It worked out all right.
Sure.
Might not have if I'd been put in charge of the agricultural division or something, it might not have worked, but this worked out fine. So after that year at Columbia, I never regretted it, but people seemed a little put off. Why, you didn't even get a master's degree, what'd you do there all year? But I felt secure in what I had done. And this combination of Washington and the Southwest worked out fine, and I gained civil service status. I've been taking civil service exam along the way, and I gained civil service status in the Indian Service, and then in beginning of April 1941, I gave up that Indian Service opportunity, much to the dismay of some people, and went and worked in the Civilian Personnel Division of the Office of Secretary of War in Washington. And 6 months later, I went to Quito, Ecuador as American Vice Consul. And I stayed down there. And then the war broke out, of course, when I was already down there. And
you were in Ecuador when the war began?
Yeah. I got there October 12th. And of course, the war came in September, December 7th. And there was a big business about that because they froze the Foreign Service personnel and couldn't get out to go carry the gun or anything. But eventually, I was reassigned to Portugal, and I came home in May of 43 and was assigned a temporary duty in the Department of State for 6 months, where I worked in the division concerned with trading with the enemy, licensing, all of these things, very instructive experiences.
Yeah, really?
Very instructive. Trading with the enemy licensing, which I learned something about. And while I was there, I eventually persuaded the Department of State to release me. Otherwise, how were we going to win the war if I didn't go out there, you see? And they did, and then I signed up in the Naval Reserve, and greatly disappointed I couldn't get a rank as a line officer. So I became a supply corps officer.
This would have been in about 40.
This is the beginning of 44 now.
Mm-hmm.
December 43 is when I went to the Navy and left the Department of State. I worked there 6 months. Nice experience. And eliminating all the internal turmoil about wanting to do the real thing and so on. And I went to the naval station at the Philadelphia Naval Yard for about 6 weeks, I guess it was, in December up until the beginning of February. And then went to Wellesley for Supply Corps School, and then went out in June to the West Coast to commission a ship in Seattle, and went as a supply officer on an attack transport, commissioned September 7th, 44, in Oregon, and went out to the Pacific, and we took part in four combat landings, two at Okinawa, and two on the western side of the Philippines, up, it'll come to me in a minute, the beaches where we landed. And I got out of the Navy, came through the canal. Well, because our ship was so late getting in, we took part in the magic carpet operation, bringing troops home. It turned out we only brought really one big batch and then a smaller batch. went through the canal and decommissioned the ship in Portsmouth, Virginia, in April of 1946, and then I was, terminal leave was up in June, and I went to work for Key on the Southern Politics Enterprise in September.
And here it is, September 1946, you're not even 30 years old, and you've already had all of this vast range of experiences.
Well, a great variety, yes.
Now,
I wasn't very high on any pole, you understand.
Yes, but to think of the range of things that you had done at that time, yeah. The value of all that is incalculable.
Well, I thought so, and a lot of people, didn't agree with this way of conducting one's career.
I think it's a fascinating way for you to...
But it was to me, I thought I knew what I was doing, and I was very happy about it. And I had employment opportunities, when I came back, but I didn't want to go on off. I had re-employment opportunities in the Foreign Service, in the State Department, and I had other employment opportunities. I mean, people who thought somebody offered me $10,000 a year to come manage his frozen chicken plant.
A lot of money then.
Well, my God, a lot of money is right. And there were some industrial opportunities in Savannah, commercial opportunities. But I wasn't interested in that. Mm-hmm. I was interested in something that had more of a public service ring. In any event, when this opportunity to come, and I was without a job there during the summer of 46.
Did you spend that summer in Savannah?
In Savannah and Little Switzerland, North Carolina, where my mother and father went for a month vacation normally, or they're somewhere else. And I went up with them. And,
when did you marry?
In June of 49.
And where? Tell me about Jean's family.
Jean was from Alabama. Her father was in public education. When she was born, he was the superintendent of schools in Covington County, I guess. Anyway, Andalusia, a town of 6,000, was where she was born. He was head of the school system there.
What is her?
Keller. K-E-L-L-E-R. Then he was elected state superintendent of schools, and they lived for 4 years in Montgomery during that. Then he went to Columbia University for a year to get a degree, a completed degree or something. And then he became president of Florence State Teachers College, now North Alabama University in Florence, Alabama. Jean went to Birmingham Southern for 1 year to study with a violin teacher, Manny Chadwick. She had been playing the violin since a little girl. And then when Chadwick moved at the end of her freshman year to the University of Alabama as the head of the string department there, she went to the University of Alabama. And she was graduated there in 46. And then she went to Juilliard for 2 years.
And where did you meet her?
Well, in March of 48, when I had never understood how the United States had been able to win the war without me as an aviator. So after I finished traveling around the South on the Southern Politics thing and was resident in Tuscaloosa, I went out and took flying lessons. And got a pilot's license, single engine land. And I came in from my piloting one afternoon late. I hope with a scarf around the neck, but no goggles. And went to have dinner in Pug's Number 2. That was the restaurant on the edge of the campus. And Mr. and Mrs. Chadwick, who had rented to the Keys their residence during the summer when VO was down in Tuscaloosa, were there, and they had this girl, and they introduced me, and we said hello, and so on. Jean said it was a terrible thing, because she was home from Juilliard, hoping to see her old professor and hear somebody. In August of that year, they had a terrible automobile accident in which they were Jean and her sister and her sister's husband and her parents were coming back from Fort Walton, Florida, to Florence, and ran into a train, and her parents were killed, and she was very badly hurt.
Oh,
terrible. and she was in the hospital in Birmingham a long time and so on. And then what's she going to do with the parents gone? And she went to live with the Chardings in Tuscaloosa.
I see.
And in December of 48, I saw her there. Somebody asked me, next door, a neighbor asked me to come by and have tea or a drink or something. And I did. And then after Christmas, I saw her. We were engaged in about 6 weeks.
Yeah. Married. Sorry about that.
No, I'm sorry. It's picking it up, I guess.
Right.
You see, when this Southern Politics Project, the one that had been organized and the funding obtained by Roscoe C. Martin, who was the director of the Bureau of Public Administration at Chairman of Political Science, University of Alabama, and that Key had conducted, and I was the assistant to Key. When that came to an end, what was I to do? And so I, as the end was approaching, I contemplated going back to the Department of State. In fact, I got a letter of reinstating me in the Foreign Service business. And there were other possibilities. But when it came right down to it, the only way I could see that I might stay in the South was to go ahead and get a PhD degree. Now, I had finished the master's degree in the course of working at the University of Alabama because I had done a piece of writing for Key that they had let me submit as the essay. And because the war had come along, there was no time limitation on the degree. And so I'd gotten permission from Columbia University to write a dissertation before I went back in the fall of 49, and then to take the coursework during the academic year 49-50 and take all those wretched examinations you have to take. Right. So I was on a full court press, I felt, and it was rather, I felt under considerable pressure how to get this dissertation written before I went up there. And the door, I'd been out of academic life for 11 years.
Sure.
But here came Gene Keller, you see. So we were, I'm writing the dissertation all this time. We were married in June, June 17th of 49. And somehow or another, before we went to New York in September, I had written the dissertation.
Gee.
And then we went up there and had to take all these terrible examinations, you know, political theory and foreign language in French and foreign language in Spanish and all these things. But anyway, survived all that and passed the orals and the writtens and whatnot and got through that whole year. And I had the stimulus to do this because in 1946, in the fall, right after I'd come to work, gone to work at the University of Alabama, I went to the Southern Political Science meetings in Knoxville, and Pat Robson, the chairman of the Political Science Department, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, had said, if you go on and decide to go into academic life and get a PhD degree, we'll have a teaching position for you at Chapel Hill. Now, in those days of burgeoning opportunities, that wasn't as extraordinary a thing as it would seem now, but it was pretty extraordinary, let me tell you. And so all this time, I knew that if I could succeed in all this, I had a job at Chapel Hill, which is a good place to be.
To back up just a little bit, in 46, when you're out of the Navy and spent that summer contemplating what you were going to do next, what was the sequence of events that brought you into contact with the University of Alabama and that project?
In the middle of the summer, I guess in August, well, when I got out of the Navy, I had written, I guess among other people, Jim Fessler, under whom I'd had a course in the summer of 1937 at Chapel Hill. He's a professor of public administration. He was one of these people who had always taken a keen and constructive and effective interest in the careers of his former students. And I wrote Jim and said, here I am. We won the war, and here I am. And I probably said, this is the kind of thing I'm interested in if you hear of anything. Well, Roscoe Martin had asked Fessler if he... No, I guess Jim Fessler, on his own initiative, had written several people, I think, and said, here, Hurd is adrift, and you know anything that might suit him. And he'd written Roscoe Martin as one of those. And Martin was at just about that point looking for someone to be an associate, an assistant to Key. Research associate was the title to Key, and that's how I got connected.
Whose idea was it to do that project? Was it Martin's idea?
Martin's idea.
He wanted to do a big comprehensive study of politics.
He started out, somewhat in consultation with Ellis Arnold, who was then governor of Georgia, contemplating a study of the poll tax, which was looked upon, even though it didn't exist in all the states as it once had and so on, was looked upon as a key impediment to a wider suffrage and so on. And as they